morning, everyone. Good evening, everyone across the planet. Welcome back to Everyday Business with your host, Tony Lontis. And we are again talking this week to real estate agent Amir Michelle. And we have been talking for many, many weeks now about real estate, and in particular, the Australian real estate market, which is incredibly hot at the moment. And one of the things I've been wanting to ask Amir is if he thinks that that hotness of the Australian real estate market will continue. But before we get on to the show, here's what you need to know. If you're listening to this show live on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and Twitch, we will have the descriptions and the links to everything that we talk about in the description below. And as you know, Amir is a multi-author of the books Where's the Bees Blueprint, and he has had decades of experience in the Australian real estate market, actually beginning when he was 10 years old, watching his wonderful parents renovate property in the Sydney area. Now, Amir started himself with $5,000, and now he has a multi-million dollar portfolio all over Australia. And today our subject is around time. And Amir and I were talking before the show, and there's lots of elements that relate to time when you're talking about real estate. And in particular, we're going to touch on the subject of international purchase of Australian property. So without further ado, good morning, Amir.
Good morning, Tony. How are you?
I'm really good, thank you. I'm absolutely ecstatic to be back on the show again this week. It's getting to the busy time of year, and I know that at this time of year and heading into Christmas, lots of people are traveling around, and I know from my own history, and I suspect it might be the same for you, Amir, that when we are traveling, if you're interested in real estate, it's not too difficult to have a look at the local real estate windows and just check out what's happening in a place where you're visiting family for the holidays, or you've actually just got some downtime and you're wandering around the street looking to see what's around. So today we want to talk about time, Amir. So time and real estate, why is it important?
I'll start with this, Tony. Yeah. If you think of nature, before you're thinking of finances, before you're thinking of real estate, just think of what happens in nature to a tree. If you're planting a seed in the first 6 months, it's very vulnerable. You get the little sprouts coming out, but anything can crush it. If there's enough seasons, enough rainfall, and I guess more importantly, if you plant the right tree in the right soil in the right area, you haven't planted a desert tree in the mountains or a mountain tree in the desert, then it thrives. If it survives 10 seasons, so it goes through 10 winters and 10 summers, the trunk is thick, it's stable, its roots are deep. And time is a blessing to trees that they get stronger, healthier, and at times more fruitful. So they have offspring, so to speak. Yes. If you think about animals, sometimes it's the opposite way. The younger animal is stronger and healthier and more vital, and a 20-year-old animal is frail. So property is a mixture between the two. What do I mean by that? Mm-hmm. Think of property as made up of two components. One of them is the land component underneath, and the other one is the building or materials above. If you create a building out of concrete, out of steel, or out of wood, any of those components can chemically react with each other, can be affected by the environment. So the summers and winters, the heat, the cold, the wind, and all the seasons, they affect the materials, whether it's the paint on the outside or even if you've got a concrete building that's steel reinforced, that steel still slowly reacts with the concrete to become more brittle, to change the nature. So what we do is we paint the reinforcement with a chemical to stop, a barrier to stop the interaction between the two. Mm-hmm. But eventually those things still wear out. So it doesn't really matter what type of material, but there is a difference in how long each material lasts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when I look at this, I think of it as splitting the Australian landscape into two. On one hand, you've got units and apartments. On the other hand, you've got a freestanding house. A unit or an apartment might have a small component of land underneath, and that land increases in value decade on decade. So every 10 years, if you look at the price of the land per square meter or for the size that you have, there's a massive difference when you own a house that has land underneath. If you're looking at it the other way, of an apartment unit, the land underneath still increases in value. But a 40-year-old or 50-year-old block of units above can be an eyesore. In fact, it can look so bad that it makes people not want to buy any of the other units. So the price of the building affects your percentage of price.
Yeah.
So think of it in nature terms of trees growing stronger with age and animals growing more frail with age, and compare it that way in your property mind.
Mm.
Now, one thing, Tony, that I've noticed is that the new Doctor Who is coming out now.
Oh.
So if you're a BBC fan and you're ready to watch the new Doctor Who season, I think it's just started 2 weeks ago or something along those lines.
Oh my goodness.
So it makes me think of the real Time Lords, that if I'm not talking about time traveling, but if we're just ordinary people, we still have control over how we use time.
Yes.
What that can affect your financial position in is when you're looking at where things were and where things are, there's always going to be a debate. Somebody's always going to say that this year is the peak, next year the prices will go down. Or maybe I went to a conference this weekend and the economist speaking about property said that their prediction is that 2026 will be the peak of the Sydney market. So prices will continue going up until 2026, and then 27 will drop below the 26 level. But they're predicting that the 27 and 28 pricing will still be higher than the 2024 and 2023 and 2024.
Yep.
So even though it peaks and then goes down, it never actually peaks and goes right back down to 10 years ago.
I was going to ask it's always going like this, but generally speaking, and this is a general statement, isn't it? It's not going to go below. So it will go right up and drop down, but it won't drop below the lowest, will it? So it's always slowly going up, yes?
So I got into quite a few heaps of discussions this weekend at the conference, but one thing that we all agree on is this. If you're looking at short-term trends, maybe a 3-month period, you can have an up and a down.
Yes.
When you extend the trend to 10 years, there's nobody that thinks that 10 years ago it was cheaper to buy property, and nobody at the conference thought that in 10 years it'll be cheaper than today. So if you're looking at 1 year or 2 years, there's debate. If you're looking at 5 years to 10 years, the debate ceases. And if you're looking at 10 years plus, there is no debate. It's just everybody thinks the same thing. Prices will go up in that 10-year block. There might be a debate by how much, but absolutely everybody agrees that the price of housing will go up in that period of time. So that's why really, when I looked at things at how can I explain it in terms of nature, in terms of animals and forests?
And trees. That
1 to 2 year period, yeah, 1 to 2 year period is, you know, depends how much rain there is, depends on the weather that summer, depends on the weather that winter, depends on natural disasters, bushfires, flooding, etc. But if you can sustain and look at a 10-year period, which in reality, in property, you are always looking at a longer period. It's not a very liquid asset. It's not something that you generally sell every 3 months.
Yeah.
So if you're considering property and real estate and you're looking at the bigger view of a 10-year period at least, some people hold on to property for 30 years, 50 years, or multi-generation into the hundreds of years. But at the very least, look at the 10-year period. If you realize and you know with 100% certainty that the property value of the land will go up, then your consideration is, what about the rest of it? So I'll give you a few examples, Tony, because we were talking about Oberon before.
Yeah.
And Oberon is 2 hours west of Sydney. If you're a drive, obviously not a walk, but 2 hours west of Sydney is still an area that has very fast internet speeds. What do I mean by very fast? I look at anything that's 100 megabits per second or higher as very fast. So Oberon has surpassed the 100 megabits per second. It's a very small township. But when I started investing in Oberon 5 years ago or 6 years ago, it had around a 2,700 person population and it was classified as a village. It's now moved to 5,700 at the last census.
Oh, really?
And the census that was done earlier this year won't be published until 2022. So we'll find out what the new numbers are in maybe about 4 months or so. We'll find out what the new numbers are.
Uh-huh.
But when I looked at it, 2,700 to 5,700 is a bumper crop. Excuse the farming analogy.
No, it is, isn't it? That's
it is
quite a rapid population growth for a small rural town.
It is. And look, it isn't necessary to know the exact population. What's necessary is to actually look at the investments, look at the house, and see whether the next five neighbours to your left and the next five neighbours to the right have been manufacturing growth. Are they knocking down and building something new, or is every house a 20 or a 40-year-old house? And you can tell street by street that there's a development. Every three or four houses is a brand new house, or at least a house built in the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
So that really gets you the feel of that area. And I'll speak about Oberon a few times because there's just so many great examples there for a little regional town that's not too far from the capital city.
Examples, haven't they? For a relatively small regional town, they've got great examples to use when we're talking about real estate. And that's why you invest there in the first place, isn't it?
That's right. That's why I researched it 7 years ago, 6 years ago, and then purchased 6 years ago to 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Because there is that delay between deciding you're going to do something and then finding somebody who's actually willing to sell.
Yeah. Yes. So you've just recently been up there to do some renovations on your property. Can I ask, how many properties have you got currently in Oberon, Amir?
Well, let's not go into that. So when I do things from a real estate perspective and a property perspective, I tend to put things in trusts and companies.
Yes.
So there's a level where who owns a property? Does your self-managed super fund own the property, or do you own it if you're one of the beneficiaries of the... Yeah, that's right. So I'm going to answer that question in a second, Tony.
Yes.
But the question there has a few different levels, and it's especially relevant to somebody who's a financial investor who's a foreigner.
Yes.
So if you're a foreign investor wanting to buy land or wanting to buy property or wanting to buy an established house in Australia, the government gives you guidelines. So here comes my disclaimer. I tend to do this every episode, don't I, Tony?
No, that's good.
Whether it's money on the line or your time on the line, always do your research. So have a look at the FIRB, the Financial Investment Review Board. You can Google it. And in Australia, there's a website that's set up to explain what the taxes are for foreigners, what the restrictions are for foreigners, and what you are and are not allowed to do if you're a foreign investor in real estate in Australia.
Yeah.
I guess one of the things that's universal for every political party in any country in the world is that you have to please the majority.
Yeah.
So if you've got a population of a billion people, if you're making 500 million, half a billion of them happy, you're doing a good job.
Okay.
It's not possible to make everybody happy.
It's not.
But it's very unlikely that a government decides to make more than half of its population unhappy. So you're going to do things that, yes, some people will complain about, but the majority will either keep quiet about it or be happy about it. And that happens in Australia just like everywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about the basic needs, let's talk about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the need for shelter, the need for food. In a way, Australia is one of the food bowls of the world. What do I mean by that? I mean that there's agriculture, there's farms producing wheat, producing sugar, producing other crops, and there's livestock, cows, sheep, coming from Australia. We do feed the Australian population from the crops and from the livestock.
Yeah.
We also feed a lot of Asia. So we're one of Asia's food bowls.
Yes.
Because of the temperature ranges that we have and the wide diversity of climates. So Australia, from the southernmost tip to the northernmost tip, has five different types of areas, where in the far south in Tasmania, you get icy cold weather, and in the hot north, you get the tropical weather.
Yes.
So we do everything from bananas to blueberries, which are more of a tropical fruit, all the way down to the best seafood in the world coming from the coldest regions of ocean. Mm-hmm. You know, that, anyway, I'm off on a rant here.
I know, that's okay.
But having a food bowl.
Yes.
Being one of Asia's food bowls makes a big difference. So one of the fears that the Australian population has is that a big American company or a big Chinese company or a big UK company will come in and buy the agriculture, buy the livestock or the farms.
Mm.
So there isn't a complete control where the government can say, look, the government will just buy everything in Australia and will restrict anybody else from doing anything. That doesn't exist in Australia. The Australian economy and the Australian government system is reasonably open compared to some of our neighbours.
Yes.
So what that means is that if a large farm is being sold that includes a lot of land,
yes,
the government has a few options, perhaps not to restrict who will buy it, but to make sure that they take enough tax off the top so that it doesn't matter if a big country outside of Australia controls that land.
Yes.
They're paying the Australian government, which in turn pays the Australians that are paying taxes. So there isn't a complete control, but they don't want to upset too many people.
Yes.
So I think before the show, Tony, we were talking about Nicole Kidman.
Yes, and large landholders.
And we're talking about large farms. Mm. When the Kidman family sold a large portion of land, it needed to get approval from the Financial Investment Review Board if they were selling it to an American entity or a foreign entity outside of Australia that doesn't live in Australia.
Yeah.
So, there's complications in if an Australian decides to start an Australian company, a PTY LTD, a proprietary limited company,
mm-hmm,
and then over the course of 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, that company buys large amounts of Australian land,
mm-hmm,
but then in 30 years or 40 years, that company is selling its shares. So it divides from starting as a small
private
personal company that's just private, not available to the public.
Mm-hmm.
As it grows, perhaps it joins the Australian Stock Exchange and starts selling portions, shares of the company.
Yes.
There could be a situation where in the future, 95% of that company is owned by foreign investors that bought shares.
Uh-huh.
But the land that was purchased in the company name originally is still owned by the same company.
Uh-huh.
So you're not selling, you're not transferring the land. There isn't the second bite of the cherry that the tax department gets.
Right.
But now what's happened is that property has been sold because the company has sold some of its shares or transferred some of the shares, which in effect meant that the ownership changed. So the government keeps a very close eye on these large interactions.
Mm-hmm.
One house doesn't make much of a difference, but 300 acres makes a difference.
Yes.
So the Financial Investment Review Board controls and monitors this type of stuff, all for the benefit of taxes, for the Australian residents, for the Australian citizens, and to keep the voters happy.
Yes.
Obviously, that's their job. It's politics.
Yes.
So where time comes into this, and this comes back to the question you asked me, Tony, of how many properties do I own now? The correct question is, how many properties do I control?
Yes.
And controlling means that if I'm a director of a company and the company owns a property, then I, in writing, give myself permission as director to go mm-hmm. in as a person to that property and paint a wall.
Yes.
So I don't need to ask permission from another person.
No.
And so at the moment, I'm working on 4 properties in Oberon, but 3 of them are ones that I have an interest in. And I'm looking to buy more properties at the moment. In fact, just yesterday, I started looking up the properties that are for sale in Oberon, looking at a specific size of land. So currently, I'm actually hunting for new properties in Oberon because 2 of them have just sold and 3 more have an offer on them. So it looks like 5 properties are going to be sold either this year or within the first few months of next year. Mm-hmm. So I'm currently looking to buy properties in Oberon. And now I'm starting the research papers and finding out who the owners are, how I contact them, all the kind of important stuff so that I can start putting out feelers to find out who's interested in moving out of Oberon, because I've got Sydney buyers that want to buy in Oberon, partly for myself and partly for other customers that are using me as a buyer's agent to buy in Oberon on their behalf.
Absolutely.
And it's amazing how many people from Sydney, from Melbourne, from Brisbane want to buy an Oberon.
Just going to ask that question. And in terms of what you're looking for, you have a formula, and I know that you use that when you're researching property. But in Oberon, and let's consider Oberon specifically, is there a sized block with a house or whatever on it that you specifically are looking for? Is it like 1,000 metres, 600 square metres? What's the land size, or does it vary based on what the property is?
I look for properties that are very close to the centre of town. And so the block size can be about 650 or 700, but the block size that people like, the favoured block size, is 800 square metres or more. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking for a block size that's 1,700 square metres up to about 8,000 square metres.
Yep.
Why? Because that's a sweet spot. I can cut it into 2. I can make a 4,000 and a 4,000. Yep. Or even from a 1,700, I could make an 800-800. Yep. And that extra 100 square metres might be the shared driveway that allows both driveways to work independently without... That's right, without having to write into the contract who owns which bit. So it does make things a little bit easier if I'm doing any future planning. So, 1,700 square metres up to about 8,000 square metres. I find anything bigger than that is available, but it's not as close to the centre of town. So it might be a 10-minute drive from town, which might be okay unless it's snowing. But if you're in the centre of town, you can get everywhere and, you know, all the supermarkets, the veggie shops, the cafes, the lake, the golf course, the RSL club, all the DVD rental place, the library, all the important things, the pharmacy, they're all within a walk or a drive at most. But Oberon's such a dense little town that within that township, 5 minutes in any direction from where the Oberon Council is still an easy drive, and you get the same kind of facilities, whether it's that faster internet, whether it's the bus routes, or there's a bus that goes to Sydney. So you want to be, you know, close enough to the right kind of logistics so that you don't have to drive half an hour in the snow when it's an emergency. I forgot the whole time question.
Before we go back to the time question, I have so if I was an investor and I said to you, Amir, I like what's happening in Oberon. Can you find me a property? And I want it 3-bedroom. I want this size. I want it this close to the. That's exactly what you do. That's your forte, isn't it? Because you've done the research around Oberon. So you can go to, you can say to me, okay, Tony, this is what you're looking for. This is about the price you'll pay. This is around about where you'll get good value. And this is the rent if you want to rent the property out. This is what you'll get. This is the potential for the future. This is the predicted growth, et cetera, et cetera. That's what you do, isn't it, Amir?
Yeah, that's my full-time job. So my full-time job is acting as a buyer's agent for you, hunting down properties and negotiating for them, as well as if you choose to use me to do the other steps, then I can recommend your tradespeople that'll help with the renovation, that will help with any kind of structural repairs that need to be done, any kind of asbestos removal that you want to do before tenants move in, all the really fiddly stuff that require licenses, I've done it enough times and used licensed people enough times to know who to recommend and who to stay away from. And that it covers so many different fields in property, but as long as it's property specific, that's pretty much what I do in the 40 hours a week that I do the work part of my life.
And I mean, self-managed super funds, even. If I had a self-managed super fund, I could still go to you. Amir, my self-managed super fund wants to purchase property in Oberon. Can you find me something? And you'd be able to do that relatively easily.
I would. And the financial planner that you're using, who's going to give you the statement of advice, is going to outline with discussion with me how that looks like, how many years you're planning to keep the property, whether with a self-managed super fund, you might want a single contract. So that means you might want to buy land with nothing on it and then build something on it. But instead of the super fund taking the risk of that building stage, you might prefer to, or your financial advisor might tell you it's mandatory to, buy the thing as a one-stop shop, meaning that when the super fund purchases, they would purchase a house and land package as one contract from one builder, for example. And then the builder takes responsibility of everything up to the handover the keys where the complete house is a finished residential property. If your super fund deed allows for residential property to be purchased, because it's not automatic.
No,
you do need to have things written up the correct way. So another disclaimer, but make sure you get the correct advice before you start, before you set up your self-managed super fund deed, before you open any accounts, get the correct advice from a financial planner, an accountant, and your legal professional to say, yes, this is going to be a bear trust. This is going to be a lend. This is going to be non-lending. If there is a lend, does the contract specify that it's a limited recourse lend, meaning that they can't sue the self-managed super fund for something that hasn't, you know, that, so that it gets more complicated, but, you know, my lane is in the hunting. So I hunt for the property. But yes, I could do that as long as you're working with the right professionals, that I could do that for your self-managed super fund as well. And Oberon, because of the price point, there's properties available from 100,000 to 2 million. But the majority of them are between the 300,000 and 600,000, which is kind of a sweet spot for self-managed super funds.
Correct. Okay. So back to our time question, which is what we wanted to talk about today, because time is an important consideration for real estate. And it's even more important if you're purchasing from overseas. So what is that time consideration in real estate?
So one of the normal type of considerations, and I say normal because if you think of the bell curve and the majority of the people form a certain group, and then there's outliers on one extreme and outliers on the other extreme, we're looking at the majority of the bell curve. So in that area where the majority of the people function, they feel that time works for them if they buy in an early year, because the price hasn't gone up by that 10-year period we're talking about, but they have to pay for it at a later year. So if you buy at today's price, but the bill comes due in 5 years' time, majority of people find that to be a good thing because the price is locked in, but you're not paying interest. So how that works with a foreigner is that, let's say that the restrictions on somebody buying an Australian property is that they only buy a new house. So they would find something where there's a land in Oberon that has 800 square meters and they want a brand new house built on it. They apply through the Department of Foreign Investment and Trade, through the FIRB, through the Foreign Investment Review Board, and through their paperwork, they submit that they are allowed to buy in this and this name or this and this company, whatever they do with the government website. Now they put a deposit against the house and land, perhaps with a builder who's going to give them the finished product. And the builder estimates it'll take 3 years to finish building because they need to apply first for permission with council. No, just the council, the process, the reviews. You're paying perhaps a staged payment. So you might pay the land component first. Mm-hmm. Then when the first stage of the building is complete, the slab, the concrete base that everything goes onto is finished, somebody local gives you a report. They're usually called a quantity surveyor. So you send out a quantity surveyor to inspect the site and make sure that the concrete slab is dry, has been laid correctly, and forms the correct area that you're expecting. Mm-hmm. And then they authorize your bank or yourself to make that payment to the builder as a progress payment, as a milestone payment. Mm. So as every stage progresses, you're only paying for a portion of that final amount. So in 3 years' time, that quantity surveyor may have gone there three times and said, yes, now the walls are installed. Yes, now the concrete slab is installed. Yes, now it's finished and ready, habitable and livable, and has a certificate from the local council to give it occupancy. So an occupancy certificate means somebody can occupy it legally, meaning that the council or somebody who the council authorizes has inspected and said, yes, the windows are the correct height above the floor, the correct amount of insulation is used. Mm-hmm. You haven't broken any restrictions on how low the ceilings are. Mm-hmm. So they've done the basic inspection, not to check for the color of the house, but to check that you've complied and followed the Building Code of Australia. Australia is very strict on what materials are not allowed to be used, what materials must be used, how big openings are, how big doorways need to be, how safe is a window that's above a certain height, all the restrictions that make living in Australia safe. And that really works in your favor when you're building a brand new house, because think of it this way. If you follow the guidelines that tell you how a safe house feels like and looks like, you've got wider doors, wider windows, and a safe house to live in. So those restrictions actually work in your favor when you're building new. Yes, you have to comply with them, but why wouldn't you if it's a house you're going to keep? So it makes sense to follow it. It's also compulsory. So that means that that time has now worked in your favor. Remember what we said at the beginning, Tony? That the land underneath your house is the bit that's likely to increase in value. But the house, from when you build it, will start depreciating, in other words, reducing in value. So if you're thinking about how your money is spent and you can hold on to the land for as long as possible so that the value of the land goes up and the building gets finished at a certain point of time, let's say 3 years in time, it is pristine at that stage. It is brand new. It is a house that, if you've designed it well, is attractive to anybody you want to sell it to. It's attractive for anybody who you want to rent it to, and it's attractive for you to live in. So it ticks all the boxes. And what that means from a portfolio or a wealth building point of view, it also gives you that three-year period to apply for a resident visa in Australia or to apply for a student visa in Australia or a working visa in Australia. It gives you the time to allow, especially if you've done your area research, especially if you've done the area research on the area and you've chosen well, if you've used the right kind of blueprint to get the good example of how to analyze and how to choose and how to negotiate on an area that's moving forward, not backwards, then that time has worked for you like a tree, not against you like an animal. So rather than becoming frail, it's becoming stronger with time. And isn't that what we all want? We want our children to have an easier life than us. We want our future to be better than our past. So that's, again, it's one of these normal, average, universal considerations that the majority of people want the future to be better than the past.
Definitely. So that's the time consideration when you're an international or foreign investor in Australia, because there's it takes time to go through those processes, doesn't it?
It does. And time is on, as long as you put your foot down on the property, as long as you've committed to the property and nobody can sell it out from under you because you've paid your deposit and the contract, the ink is dry on the contract, and you've done it through the correct legal conveyancer or solicitor in the state that you're purchasing in or the territory you're purchasing in. So as long as you've done the correct things from your point of view and your solicitor and conveyancer has filled in the paperwork or created the paperwork to be in your favour, then time is in your favour.
Amir, do you always, and another disclaimer, do you recommend using solicitors in the state in which you are purchasing, or does it not matter so much? What's your experience in that?
So I've had experience with both. There's a benefit on one hand to use one solicitor company or conveyancing company that has an office in every state and territory, because they quite often are centralized, meaning that they've got an electronic or a website or a digital platform that allows for signatures, and then any originals that need to be sent in, they're usually sent to either a PO box or to a delivery address that is monitored all the time. So in a way, using a larger company that's Australia-wide might be of benefit to you. The other thing that people don't think about is if you go for the solicitor or conveyancer specific to the territory or specifically to that state, they actually have relationships with the other solicitors that you're negotiating with. So one of the things that I heard this example on Saturday, 2 days ago. There was a purchase of a property where the settlement was delayed, and the buyer had told the seller, or it was negotiated beforehand, that after settlement, the house was going to be bulldozed, knocked down and demolished, and a brand new house was to be built in that area. Because of the delay in the settlement date, obviously everything had to be changed to the new date after settlement had occurred. But one of the parties along the way wasn't informed. So the house was demolished while it was still owned by the other person. So nobody was living in it. It was vacant. Nobody got hurt. But one day before the new settlement date, the bulldozer came and demolished the house. And the vendor, the person selling, noticed. They didn't live in the house, but either one of their neighbors told them, or they noticed that before settlement, something had happened that was not supposed to have happened. So, that's right. So if you have two parties where the solicitors don't know each other, there can be a screaming match. It can go to the newspapers and television and the internet. You can imagine the type of scenario that could have been built out of this nothing. I mean, really, the settlement was for the next day anyway, and the house was going to be demolished one day later anyway. So when one solicitor calls the other one and says, yes, we're still going to buy the house, even though the house is demolished, we don't need the bank to approve that the demolished house is actually there, etc. So as long as there's a conversation between the two parties and it doesn't escalate into a conflict where it doesn't need to be, then, you know, exactly. I mean, it doesn't really matter. It's one day's difference. Legally, it matters if the bank says, we're letting you buy this house, and you haven't told the bank you're going to bulldoze the house. That's a different story. But if you're using a local conveyancer and a local solicitor, there's a chance that they know the other side's solicitor and conveyancer, and there's normally a more civil conversation if things that are unexpected happen. But as long as the company you're using is licensed in the state or in the territory that you're using, and there is a way to check that through Google, through the internet, most states have a list that say this license is valid, et cetera, et cetera. So it makes sense to check the currency and the type of license the person that you're using has. But look, whether you're using a national or you're using a local, it shouldn't make a difference. It's only personal preference. And if you're doing a large portfolio of 10 to 20 properties and you're doing a transaction every 2 months or 3 months, sometimes it makes sense to use the national, because if they're in different states and different territories, you get a good idea of how their system works. So It's just easier for you to do the same thing on your second, your third, your 15th property, etc. If you're only buying one every 2 years or 3 years, or you do a property transaction twice in your life, perhaps choose a local that'll tell you the local way things are done. But no, there isn't a hard and fast rule, and I've found both of them are quite good, as long as you find somebody who has good reviews and a reputable company.
Absolutely, absolutely. Amir, so that was where a good example of where timing has impacted, although it was a good outcome in this instance. Would it have made much difference, do you think, if the settlement date had been pushed a week out versus a day out? Would that have had a much impact?
Yeah.
It would have, wouldn't it?
That would have had a very big impact. Yeah. The reason for that is in a lot of contracts in Australia, there's a allowance to do the last walkthrough, the last inspection, within 1 week of the settlement date.
Yeah, so that's...
If you couldn't do your inspection, no house, no walkthrough. If you couldn't do your last inspection, then it's not a breach of contract, but you've put yourself into a grey area.
Yeah.
You've put yourself into a grey area because, yes, you're not allowed to do what you've done. If something changes, and we're talking probably more if you're getting lending for the property.
Correct.
Sometimes the bank changes their policy. So Australia has four major banks, and those major banks have smaller banks that they own that are owned under the same umbrella, but they have a different branding. They have a different title, but it's still owned by the same company.
And different policies.
For example, Westpac. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. For example, Westpac and St. George.
Yeah.
If you look at the bank that you're using, and it might be one of the top four banks in Australia, they would get a memorandum that circulates from their head office when they make a change. Mm. If your approval is in two categories, so an approval for lending generally starts off as a hypothetical request. So you make a very rough request saying, if I was to buy something approximately this price, and I have approximately this much money in my bank account, and I earn approximately this much money from my job, the bank looks at your example and says, well, here's a letter to say, probably we would lend you money if everything stays the same, unless things change on our side or change on your side or change with the building. So here's the catch, Tony. If your job changes before settlement, before the house is yours, you have to tell the bank that it's changed. It says that in your contract. Yeah. If the building that they looked at in your example is different to the building at the end, you have to tell the bank. If the bank gets a change in their policy, they can choose whether to comply with what they told you we're still going to do back then with your example, but it's not compulsory for them to do it. So let's say a year and a half ago, when things changed in the financial markets to change the status of jobs that were not essential workers. So some people that worked in an office could not show up to the office anymore. And they changed their duties to be a different type of duty for an unknown period of time in the future. The banks can choose to now accept it or not accept it. And that would depend on how risky your job title was, according to what the bank's head office told them in an email. So if you were working in the flights industry and flights in and out of Australia were restricted, then the bank has not the obligation, but the opportunity to say, from now until the next unknown period of time, we're not going to consider lending to somebody who works in the flights industry. Whether you're a baggage handler, whether you're a flight attendant, whether you're a pilot, the banks can say, well, we don't know what the future holds, so we're doing zero lending to that segment of the economy from today onwards.
Okay.
If you bid at auction and you signed and paid your deposit on auction day, let's say it was a Saturday, and this news came out on the Tuesday, you're committed to buying that property. So you've put your deposit down, you can't pull out. So in New South Wales, there's no cooling off period if you bought at auction. You've put in your 10% deposit. Now, maybe fewer people want to invest because the world economy has changed. The travel industry has changed.
Yeah.
You're now in this very precarious, very scary type of environment where you don't know your own future. The bank doesn't know your future. You don't know if you can afford it, but you can't find somebody else to jump into your shoes and to buy it at the same price you bought it at because news has just come out on the Tuesday.
Yeah.
So the banks will now restrict your industry, but the other potential buyers that may have been there at auction are no longer there. They've decided that they lost that one, so they went, they bought something else.
Yeah.
It puts you in a very risky situation. So when we said that there was three different levels of the stage that the lending is at, the first one is that hypothetical talk of saying, if you're earning this and the house looks like this and you've got that much money in your account, we'll probably say yes. That's sometimes called a pre-approval. When you move to the next stage, that's usually between that pre-approval and then you win at auction. You send your contract for what you just bought to the bank. The bank looks at it, and then they send somebody to the house to have a look, either from the outside or on their computer, or quite often now they actually walk inside the house, take photos, write a report and send it back to the bank. If the bank is using this new house as the security against the loan, so they're lending you a percentage of that house's value, it depends whether you went from pre-approval to formal approval without settlement. So settlement is the final stage when they actually hand over the money. Once they hand over the money, that's a different set of laws and a different set of conditions. But in that space between your pre-approval and your formal approval, some type, whether it might be a six-week period from your auction date to settlement date, during that time, it might take them a week, 3 weeks, 5 weeks to send the valuer through to make sure the property has the correct value. Let's say that they've left it to a week before settlement and the house has been knocked down. The valuer comes out, they drive to the location and there's no house at the location. The bank says, you should have told us, you didn't tell us, you've broken your contract, we're out. If the bank pulls out at the last minute, if you go to a different bank, you still have to tell them that there was a previous bank and they rejected you. So put yourself in the shoes of the new bank. They're going to be very suspicious.
Definitely.
More importantly, they're going to look at the empty spot where the house was and still say that it's an empty spot. So if it happened a week before settlement rather than a day before settlement, it would depend whether your formal approval was put through or not, or whether you're still at the pre-approval stage. It'll depend whether the asset that you had, the security, was only that house, or whether you can just substitute, in other words, swap over what the bank was going to use as security to give you the lending for your other house, your other investment property, or the house that you live in. And if they allow that to happen quite quickly and you can still make the correct settlement date, you might be okay. But if you didn't tell them you're going to knock it down and you knocked it down without their permission, even after settlement, remember we said there's three stages, the pre-approval, the formal approval, and after settlement. So they've lent you the money. It's unconditional. They've lent you the money. They've transferred the money to the vendor, to the person who sold you the house. Then you knock down the house without telling them. Again, you've broken the law. The contract says that they're lending you the money on the condition that there is security there. So all of a sudden, without telling them, you've taken away the house that they own 80% or 90% of, they're not going to be happy. So it's,
no.
there's so much involved with knocking down a house, especially if you're doing any lending. If you're borrowing, not lending, if you're borrowing.
Yeah.
If you're doing borrowing through a bank or a financial institution or even private lending, the minute that you've got somebody who's given you money to do something, they have to know and they have to approve it in writing for you.
Yeah.
Sometimes when we were talking before about building on the piece of land and the builder giving you a stage-by-stage contract to say they're responsible for both the land and the house up to the level that you agreed on for this amount of money. If you've done that with a bank, the bank has approved what they call quite often a construction loan. Then on the construction loan, they realize that during the first period of time, the house will be knocked down, will be bulldozed and removed and demolished. They realize this, they agree to it, and they only release part of the money to allow you to buy the land, to demolish the house, to build a concrete slab before they pay out the next amount of money, to build a frame for the house before they release the next amount of money, to do the finished product before they release the final amount of the money. So because the bank realizes this, they're only lending you the proportion they're comfortable with against the security that they control. It might be the land that they own until you've finished everything. So they realize that and they've approved it. So yeah, it's not always a disaster to have something knocked down before you own it. It's not a clever thing to do. So make sure if something changes with the settlement date, you change all your contractors, all your demolition crew, all the equipment you're going to rent, anything you want to deliver to site. Keep a record of everything. So if something changes, follow the list and write, change all of this, change the mailing address, change the delivery address, change the demolition date. If you have things written down and you have reminders set in place, when one thing changes, you can shift everything like a checklist.
When we're talking about building a house too, there's a whole range of little things that you have to make sure happen so that the bank will release those funds to your builder, having done that process a number of times. There's always something, if the plumber doesn't give you a certificate to certify that the plumbing, the bank won't release the money. It's same with electric, same with the slab, same with the various stages of a construction loan. They're very stringent, or I've found that they're very stringent on, you have to have this done, this certification, this checked off, and then we'll release the money. So they manage their money judiciously, one would say, in a construction of a house process, don't they?
They do.
And then the other
thing is, we spoke about the occupancy certificate. You won't get an occupancy certificate if you don't have the plumbing done or the electricity done, if the slab doesn't have the right amount of plastic underneath to stop the borers, termites and other insects coming through. So there's a lot of compliance that, especially in Australia, we have the Building Code of Australia, and it specifies how thick each sheet of plastic has to be between one thing and another thing, how much separation there has to be between earth and the wood in the stud wall so that a termite can't crawl from one surface to the other, how close the trees are to the foundation or to the house. So there's a lot of restrictions, and they're done because of experience. So in the past, things have gone awry.
Doesn't it?
It does. It protects the building.
Because the government essentially doesn't want you to build something that's going to be destroyed by termites in 5 years, effectively. So you know,
they want something that won't harm you, won't harm your neighbours, and won't harm the environment. So they do restrict the energy efficiency of a house. They make sure that it's built with materials that are not dangerous or harmful to animals, to people, etc. So there is a large amount of research that has gone into it. Because think of the number of people living in Australia. We're not as large as the US, but we still have roughly 20 million people. And of the 20 million people, how many houses have there been in history in Australia? So you'd think that there'd be at least 5 million to 10 million houses that were built, demolished, and new houses built. So when somebody has the experience of 10 million times,
yeah,
they kind of know what they're doing and right. What went wrong in the past. Mm-hmm. If they see the same thing happens that goes wrong in the past, they write it into the next version. So we had maybe 5 years ago a fire in Victoria, in Melbourne, of the external part of the house. That's called the cladding. So the outside of the house became too hot and caught fire. So the new buildings have to have a specific Australian standard that they hit, that they conform to, so that it's safe and the same tragedy doesn't happen a second time.
Amir, just quickly before we run out of time, do you think Australians' building codes are some of the strictest in the world in your experience?
In my experience, yes, but I don't have any experience building overseas, so I can't really speak to that. I know that if you look at building...
In talking to Americans or talking to people building in, say, Indonesia, they're very different standards to what Australians expect, yeah?
True. If you look at Russia and you look at India, in Australia, let's talk asbestos for a moment. Asbestos is a mineral that's found in the earth. So you can mine it, you can dig it up. It looks like a rock that little bits come off. Almost wool. It looks like a rock that has little woolen fibers that can be pulled out of it.
Yeah.
In Russia, they mine for asbestos. They produce asbestos in a factory. They mine it from the ground and they separate it to make building products out of. In India, they build with asbestos. In Russia, they build with asbestos. In Australia, they don't.
We don't.
So from the year 2003, everything in Australia that was building is not allowed to use any components that contain asbestos. There was a ban from 2003 on any asbestos used in any building materials.
Yeah.
If good you were to Australian. Build in the year 2000, good for Australian. Mm. If you were to build in the year 2000, and let's say that you put in an application to council to make the building in 1995, you bought your asbestos sheeting, you bought your asbestos roof, and you stored them somewhere, and the building was going to be inspected in the year 2000 and use some of the old materials because they stopped producing them in around 1985.
Yeah.
But if there was still a surplus, if there was leftover or if you imported them from overseas, it might have been in your garage, it might have been in the warehouse for that factory. Yeah. So yes, you might get a cheap price on them. And they wouldn't fail your house if you built your house in 2000 with asbestos that you could prove wasn't manufactured recently.
Yeah.
So in a 2001 house or a 2000 building, you might get asbestos in it and you just wouldn't know.
Yeah.
But if it's built from 2003 onwards, it's guaranteed to not have asbestos because it wouldn't get a pass for the materials that are in there.
Yeah.
It would not get an occupancy certificate. In 2021, you can build a house with asbestos in Russia, in India.
Yeah.
In Australia, you can't.
Yeah.
So that's just one type of harmful material. Yeah. Australia is also very famous for not using chemicals like formaldehyde.
Yes.
Formaldehyde
dangerous stuff.
is a preserving chemical. It stops things from rotting, if you think of it that way.
Yeah.
Especially useful in wood. In furniture. So if you were to import furniture from China, from India, you might find that their glue uses formaldehyde, that their bonding agent, like the lacquer or the paint they use, uses formaldehyde. Australia outlaws it. They don't allow it. So when we bring something in, we make sure that we have a certificate to say it hits the Australian standards or surpasses the Australian standards of not containing formaldehyde.
Mm.
Another good example is the renewable forests.
Mm.
So there's a forest stewardship council that makes sure that the source of the trees, the timber, comes from a renewable forest. So, for example, Oberon's really well known as a forestry region. It's high up in the mountains.
Okay.
It's about 1,100 sea level, above sea level.
Mm.
So If you think of Nepal and Kathmandu,
yes,
it's also 3,000 feet above sea level.
Yes.
So Oberon is 1,113 above sea level, which is over 3,000 feet above sea level. So it's in an alpine area.
Yes.
So the forests there are different from forests that grow in the, you know, closer to sea level. At that elevation, there's a different type of timber. The renewable forests in Oberon have the Forest Stewardship Council approval because they planned a 3-year, a 5-year, a 10-year, a 15, and a 30-year-old forest, and they only harvest from the correct region that's gone through the correct amount of growth. And they include a, think of a walkway so that if there's animals living in one part of the forest and they need to move their habitat to a different, there's quite often a heritage corridor that allows for the natural movement of animals and fauna from one part of the forest to the other. Yeah. So there's a lot of things that Australia does to look after its animals, its wildlife, and its forests to make sure that in 200 years, 400 years, we still have a sustainable and renewable way of life.
Yeah.
One of those things is just replanting forests or planting more than what you take down.
Yeah.
So replacing more than what you take. The other thing is conservation, making sure that the land isn't stripped of its minerals. So the amount of times it can be harvested before replenishing the oil for replenishing the earth for things like selenium. So you think of selenium, you think of magnesium, and you think of the natural minerals in the earth. If you keep digging out the same type of thing, you're losing a lot of the minerals. I mean, this really isn't property or it's more of an environmental topic.
I know, I was just going
to
say.
But property has a lot to do with the environment.
It does because of the products we use in building property. Amir, I hate to cut off this subject right now, but I know and am conscious of time and we are completely out of time for this week. And we'll be back next week to talk once more with Amir Michelle, our real estate agent, property tycoon, and we'll be back next week on Radio Tony Everyday Business with Amir and we'll talk some more property. That's our lot for this week. Thank you so much, Amir. Bye for now.